It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with the weekend host of All Things Considered, Michelle Martin. She'll be in Wisconsin tomorrow for a discussion on the purpose of higher education that will bring together students, journalists, legislators, and more to share their thoughts. First, today, President Donald Trump signed a revised executive order of his travel ban barring migrants from predominantly Muslim countries. This order is updated from a January ban on residents from 7 Middle Eastern and African countries. That travel ban began on the day it was issued and was blocked by federal judges. Kimmy King joins us now to talk about the new executive order and how it looks different from the previous one and what legal challenges could emerge. She's a professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton. Kimmy, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be here.
Well, what's different about this revised travel ban from the original issued 6 weeks ago?
I think the Trump administration would argue it's a leaner, cleaner executive order than the first time around. The chaos that was precipitated the first time was a function of not having consulted with relevant departments about what is the best strategy going forward and not fully articulating what the government's interests were and how it related to the persons that it was seeking to limit travel on. And so that's where the real crux came in, that it was in somehow a religious ban, that it was overbroad, and that it wasn't getting at the real interests that the Trump administration were saying, you know, needs to be protected.
And you referenced the provision in the previous ban that granted special status to members of religious minorities. That's gone in this version, and critics said that gave that privilege to Christians. Will that remove most of the arguments left against it from a legal standpoint, Kimmy?
That does limit that, but you still have a number of due process concerns about what rights of access perhaps family members may have for trying to get family members over. It also focused in on those that have visas already and tried to clarify when and under what circumstances those could be limited. It's certainly much more open as it relates to the visa holders this time around, and that also addresses some of the concerns about due process. It didn't go into effect right away. It has 10 days to go into effect. That was another concern, to give folks notice that this could happen. And most importantly, it eliminated Iraq, which everyone said, the Defense, State Department, Homeland Security said was a concern about not allowing Iraqi persons over here.
Based on your perspective, do you think that these changes, the ones you just outlined, fundamentally alter the substance of the law?
I think they give the Trump administration more credibility that it's trying to protect the national interest. But remember, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision that struck down the executive order really raised concerns about whether or not President Trump had shown and properly provided the proper national interest. Recall that he's claiming he has the authority to do this under a 1950s law, which Congress gave him the authority to, in essence, put in place restrictions if there are persons who are a threat to the national interest. But given that the six countries that now remain have not been where terrorist threats have come from in the United States, I guarantee when they have the arguments on this case, and they will, there will be much consternation about whether or not those six countries are really where we should be focusing.
Kimmy King is with us now, professor of political science at the University of North Texas, and she's joining us to look at the new executive order that President Trump signed today from a legal perspective. And Kimmy, what do you see as the biggest changes in this new revised travel ban?
So the biggest changes are the narrowing on Iraq, especially because that meets the concerns of both the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense, and also getting rid of that religious ban, the religious preference, I should say, for Christians who are seeking persecution. And it also recognizes that you won't have as much of a showdown between the Congress and the President over this granting of visas. If you look at who is allowed to regulate immigration under the Constitution, that's an authority that traditionally falls to Congress under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. But because Congress has delegated its authority to the President over time for dealing with what we'll just kind of call daily operations relating to immigration, that's where the potential power struggle could come in. So part of what is going to be interesting to see is whether or not this immigration update satisfies the constituency of those members of Congress who felt like it was an outrage. I'm not sure that it necessarily will, because there are still congressional Republicans who have concerns about this, but certainly the new executive order has taken some of the heat off of this boiling pot that we have.
Well, Democrats, some Democrats at the announcement today, still very vocal in their criticism of this revised ban, saying it's an anti-Muslim ban. What are we hearing from some of those other congressional Republicans that you were talking about?
So the larger concern goes back to this national interest and whether or not we're truly protecting the national interest. And additionally, remember, there were protocols that were previously in place regarding the vetting of persons coming from those countries. What is the meaning of this extraordinary order, and what exactly does it allow for the tightening of by virtue of the president? It may also be that some congressional Republicans in general may be concerned about executive overreach. That is, it's not necessarily about this immigration provision necessarily, but it may be about just delegating away their authority on a number of critical national securities to the president, and they don't want to create a precedent of somehow looking like they're not going to thoroughly vet the executive orders that Donald Trump puts forward.
So given that, what do you see as a possible route both for President Trump and his administration to defend that the new version of the travel ban and for critics of it to attack it in the courts?
So one of the things that's interesting is that right now the Trump administration, President Trump seems to be indicating that they may take a two-track legal approach. That is, he's not necessarily saying that that first ban wasn't within his authority or that the Ninth Circuit was wrong. And so he might still leave open a challenge going forward on that, but that he would also pursue any kind of challenge that comes up, especially under this leaner, cleaner, as I'll call it, executive order. So it really comes down to what kind of backlash there is, I would say, within the next week, and the amount of either support or opposition that congressional Republicans may feel. To the extent there's a number of congressional Republicans that can amass a critical mass to line up with Democrats and perhaps challenge him on the provisions that relate to concerns about granting of visa holders or how much he's going to actually confer with congressional Republicans on these kinds of national security issues going forward, may be the kinds of things that they're looking at. Remember, part of what congressional Republicans were so unhappy about this last go-round is that there have been virtually no consultation with the relevant administrative agencies, nor with the, you know, Republican delegation. And so I think that there's part of this is just part of a larger power struggle between the President Trump's administration and the direction and the vision that congressional Republicans would like to see national security go.
Kimmy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You bet.
That was Kimmy King, professor of political science at the University of North Texas in Denton. She joined us there to look at the new executive order that President Trump signed today from a legal perspective. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, our guest says most people are wrong when they think mass incarceration is based on the failed war on drugs. We'll find out more. Right now, Michelle Martin is weekend host of All Things Considered, but over the past few years, she's gotten out of the studio and into communities across the country to take a look at national issues through a local lens. These conversations are billed as Michelle Martin Going There. And the next stop is here in Wisconsin tomorrow evening. The event is sold out, but you can participate through a live stream on the NPR website and Facebook page and by using the social media hashtag NPRYCollege. Michelle, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, in addition to your role as one of the hosts of All Things Considered, you've been involved in a project, a big project called Michelle Martin Going There. And in a literal sense, it's taken you around the country. Where did the idea for Going There come from?
You know, this is our third season, and so to be honest with you, I don't remember now. I can tell you though that the first one that we did, I don't even know that if it was even branded as such, was in Ferguson 3 weeks after the unrest there in Ferguson, Missouri. We were, as I think people remember who follow these things, that, you know, Michael Brown was killed on August 9th, and that the all the events that kind of followed that happened pretty quickly, and we were asked by St. Louis Public Radio to come to help facilitate a community conversation. We were there 3 weeks after those events occurred, and after that event, which was very intense, as you might imagine, we were asked to come back, and so we did. And so we wound up doing actually two events in Ferguson in the span of a couple of months. And also, I know that the Kresge Foundation has been supporting this work, and they have asked us to kind of just take this ball and run with it wherever it may go. And so in partnership with member stations around the country, we've been collaborating on conversations that people think they want to have. And so we get together, you know, we organize it, we pick a venue, and we invite the guests, and on we go.
Can you talk a little bit about what that first conversation or two in Ferguson were like? You walked into a situation that was very fraught emotionally, a lot of high intensity going on there, and getting people to dialogue at that moment seems like it would be extremely difficult. What was it like?
You know, Ferguson was intense, and we knew it was going to be intense. I mean, I have to tell you, you know, setting the scene for you, this was August. We met in a church in Ferguson. It would have been perhaps more comfortable to meet at the very lovely studios of St. Louis Public Radio in downtown St. Louis, but the station decided, correctly in my view, that it was more important to take that conversation to the place where things were happening. So we were meeting in a church called, you know, Wellspring Church, literally blocks away from the public safety offices and literally blocks away from where a lot of the events that had sparked the nation's attention took place. It was standing room only. It was every seat taken, standing room only. And once people heard that we were there and having this conversation, people started to come who hadn't even known about it because it went active, it went kind of viral on social media. And when a lot of the younger people, for example, who perhaps are not customary listeners to public radio, heard that this conversation was taking place, they started to come. So it was the kind of one of those. It was one of those days that you really don't forget. I mean, you don't forget being part of something like that. And many people who were there that day told us that they didn't know that there were these feelings among their neighbors, or they were not aware of the way that some of the policies that they took for granted affected other people. Similarly, there were young people who told us that they had not been in a room full of people who didn't look like them, who they didn't think cared about the issues that affected them. So, you know, obviously everybody wasn't in love with it. You know, there were some people who didn't feel that they felt that, you know, their point of view was different than perhaps the ones that were most visibly expressed. But I guess what I'm saying is that in traveling around the country these last couple of years, in having these conversations, what I have seen is that there is a real desire for people to have these kinds of conversations, but they aren't sure how to get them started. People are sort of waiting for somebody else to get it started. But once you create an opportunity for people to talk about these things, I have found that many people are very, very willing and eager and happy to have a difficult conversation.
We're talking with the weekend host of All Things Considered, Michelle Martin, about her project called Michelle Martin Going There. Her next stop is in Wisconsin tomorrow to talk about higher education. And you will be in Wisconsin this week to talk about the purpose of college education in 2017. And basically the question you're asking is, does everybody really need a college degree? And what makes this question a big one for Wisconsin, and not just for Wisconsin, but for kids and for families around the country?
Well, I would reframe it just a tiny bit to say it's not so much a question of does everybody need a college degree, but what is college for? And what does college do? What's it for? How should it be paid for? What should you do if you go? Now, we know that the Obama administration placed a high priority on college preparation and removing the barriers to college preparation or improving college preparation or college access for students from all different backgrounds. That was a high priority. We also remember, if you remember the 2008 campaign, there were a number of people who criticized him for this. I remember Rick Santorum in particular, who I do have to note has three Ivy League degrees, said that he thought that the soon-to-be president was elitist for putting such a focus on this, because he said that, you know, perhaps there are other forms of education that are equally valuable, not just to the individual, but to the society. So we're going to really try to dig into this question more broadly, which is, what is college for? And what does it do, not just for the person, but for the society, particularly in a public education system, because in a public system, you're asking everybody to help pay for it. So if everybody's helping to pay for it, is there a benefit that they have a right to expect? Should the educational system be geared toward the available jobs? Should it be geared toward the particular employment that is in that area? You know, everybody, I think a lot of people know that, you know, a lot of the land-grant university systems were very much geared toward the agricultural economy. They were very much geared toward kind of improving agricultural science and, you know, learning how to take care of livestock, you know, learning the best ways to grow crops. And that, you know, over time, you know, maybe that changes. I think it's not a secret that, you know, out west, for example, in Silicon Valley, even, you know, the high school and the middle school and even in the elementary school systems are very oriented toward the world that these parents live in and work in. I mean, they're very technologically oriented. I mean, I know I've been out west, and I've been in some of the counties in the Silicon Valley area, and, you know, I've seen kids in fourth grade, you know, doing PowerPoint presentations to present their work. And that would be shocking to some people in other parts of the country. I mean, like, you know, so I think it's a deep question of, you know, and I think that the higher education system in Wisconsin has been a source of pride. I mean, the fact is, it dates back to the state itself, to the creation of the state itself. And so I think it's very deeply ingrained in people's sense of what Wisconsin is all about. But it is also the case that many people, particularly in the state legislature, are starting to ask questions. And also, I have to tell you, not just in Wisconsin, really all over the country, a lot of people are saying, well, wait a minute, if I'm paying for this, what am I paying for? As you'll note, that there have been questions, as there are periodically, I have to say, about, you know, specific classes that are offered. You know, very often people will look at a syllabus, sometimes because their own child is going to a particular institution, and they'll say, wait a minute, I'm paying for that? What's that about again? It's an age-old question, but it's an important question, and it becomes, I think, particularly important at a time when people see resources as being perhaps more scarce than they have been in the past, and they also see perhaps they don't necessarily like how the U.S. ranks on the list of, say, skill sets compared to international students. There are also, as you would imagine, you know, really rich discussions about who should get access to this resource. Should it be people with immigrant backgrounds? You know, should it be, you know what I mean? So I think those are all the kinds of things we're going to talk about.
I want to ask you about the panel, because you have this really broad representation of people who are going to be at this panel besides yourself. There'll be Charlie Sykes, conservative talk show host, cartoonist Linda Barry, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, Stephen Thompson from NPR Music, and that's a broad cross-section. And these aren't necessarily, you know, the group of people you'd find hanging out together on a Tuesday night. So what happens when you bring people like that together that don't normally dialogue about an issue like this?
Well, you know, the other thing I do want to point out, we're also having a great panel of current students, too. I do want to make sure that that part of the story gets
UW
out there.
Three students, you know, joining you.
Yeah, four. Yeah, four students. And I think that, we're actually having two panels. One is a panel of current students, and the other is a panel of how should we say, previous students, post students, who are going to give their ideas about what they think college is for. You know, one of the reasons we invited Charlie Sykes, of course, is in addition to being, you know, a very well-known talk show host who just recently hung up his microphone, although I do point out that he's been helping out with a national series called, you know, Indivisible. He's been helping out in New York mm-hmm. once a month for the last couple of months. He's written a couple of books with a provocative thesis around higher education. You know, one of them's called Fail You, The False Promise of Higher Education. So that's one of the reasons that we invited him. Linda Barry, of course, you know, who doesn't know Linda Barry? Stephen Thompson, one of our favorites, of course, a little biased there. but one of the things that we have found is that how can I put it this way? Maybe it's the service that we provide is bringing together a group of people who otherwise would not necessarily be hanging out together on a Tuesday night and seeing what would happen, and also bringing them together so that they can share ideas in a way that they generally don't get a chance to do. I mean, it's you know, I tell people, you know, perhaps the easiest way for me to describe it is what it isn't. You know, it's not a constitutional convention. We are not charged with, you know, debating legislation. It is not a town hall. People don't just, you know, get up and sort of testify and yell at each other. But what we do have are the kinds of conversations that I think many people would like to have. And maybe it's kind of in our heads, it's our idealized Thanksgiving dinner, except that we don't serve food. Well, we do serve food, actually. There is a reception, which is one of the reasons, which is one of the good parts about actually coming in person to these events, is that we always have a little bit of a reception afterwards. We do, you know, have, you know, a little nosh or some cookies or at least, you know, something to drink. It's kind of your idealized high-level Thanksgiving conversation, which is which you would have if you know, all of your relatives actually came to talk about one thing instead of complaining about, like, their arthritis or something. And they all get to share their ideas, and everyone is invited because he or she has some stake in the conversation of some particular point of view to share. So we're really excited about this, particularly the opportunity to talk with, you know, both current students about what brought them what, you know, what's their story? What's your journey here? And why are you here? And what are you hoping to have happen? And also for people who are, you know, have a different vantage point, either as representatives of the people or as people who navigate different points of view, or people who just want to tell a story of how they've used their education for themselves.
Michelle, thank you so much for joining us. And we hope you enjoy Wisconsin and have a wonderful conversation here.
Oh, I can't wait.
Michelle Martin is weekend host for All Things Considered on NPR. Her event in Madison tomorrow is sold out, but there are still ways to join in. It'll be streamed live through the NPR website and also through NPR's Facebook page. You can also engage on social media with the hashtag NPRYCollege. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to a law professor about mass incarceration and how he says we can achieve reform. I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the WPR News Department is launching a year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. We'll hear the first installment and get an overview of the project. First, prison reform is a big issue in the United States on the local and national level. From the FBI investigation into Wisconsin's troubled youth prisons to President Donald Trump's declaration during his campaign that he was the law and order candidate, questions surrounding the effectiveness of prison as it stands today remain on the table. That's probably because the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of its prisoners. America has more prisoners than any other nation and the highest incarceration rate in the world. John Pfaff joins us now to talk about the causes behind mass incarceration. He's a professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of the book Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
How does the United States look against its fellow liberal democracies like England and Germany when it comes to our rates of mass incarceration?
We are staggeringly higher than where they are. So our total incarceration rate is on the order of about something around 650 to 700 people per 100,000. England, which has the highest rate in Western Europe, is around 200. Places like France and Germany are around 95 or 100 per 100,000. So we're about 6 to 7 times higher than many European countries.
But it wasn't always like that, right? There was a time when the United States was on par with countries like that, and then suddenly this divide emerged. What happened?
So, yeah, you're right, that between the 1920s to the mid-1970s, the United States maybe was slightly more punitive than Europe, but not by much. And our rate was fairly stable at around 100, 120 per 100,000 people. And then in the mid-1970s, it started to grow. And it didn't really explode. We talk about sort of this explosion in incarceration. I don't think that's right. It just grew at this steady, unrelenting pace for basically 40 years until 2010, when it finally leveled off and started sort of a slow, very gradual decline that continues to today. And we don't really have a great understanding of exactly what drove it. Some of it was rising crime. Crime was going up during the 60s and 70s, and some of that rise in incarceration was a reaction against that. But the fact is that as crime fell starting in the 1990s, prison populations kept rising and rising as well. And so what I've spent the past sort of 10 years of my life doing is trying to figure out really what's been behind it.
And it has it hasn't reversed hugely, but it sounds as though there has been a little bit of contraction in the last several years, right?
There has, although it's important to realize that over half of the decline has taken place just in the state of California, and half the states in the country have seen their prison populations rise during that time, and half have seen them fall. So we're still not in some sort of broad national decline. When prison populations rose, all 50 states saw their populations rise. As they decline, it's only half the states, and most of that is just one state. So it's still a very, very tentative and slow-going process right now.
Now, in your book, you challenge what you call the standard story about why rates are going up, and these include three things, three tenets of the standard story, that the war on drugs, draconian sentencing laws, and the private prison complex. You take those on. What do you think is wrong with the standard story?
The problem with the standard story isn't that what it points to are irrelevant. The war on drugs, longer sentences, private prisons, those have mattered. But they're always secondary to something else that's more important, and that more important thing gets lost in the debate. So we talk about the war on drugs. But the fact is, in the state prison system that holds almost all the prisoners nationwide, only 16% are in prison for drugs. And over half of all people in prison are there for a violent crime. So if you really want to cut back on prison populations, at some point we'll start to have to ask really difficult questions about how do we punish people who have been convicted of violence. And when we talk about longer sentences, most people spend, I think, less time in prison than the average person thinks. That the median time in prison someone convicted of violence spends is about 4 years. For a drug or a property crime is barely a year. And what's really driven prison growth isn't people getting locked up and spending really long periods of time there. In fact, we've just been admitting more and more and more people. And that points not to these legislative sentences, but the prosecutor, these county prosecutors become more aggressive. And when we talk about private prisons, only about 8% of all prisoners are held in private prisons. Almost everyone is held in the state prison. And people refer to private prisons as these great profiteers of incarceration, and it's true they make a profit. But the two biggest firms made about $400 million combined on prisons last year. Wages alone for the public prisons came to $25 billion versus $400 million, right? So guard unions have a much bigger role in driving this than the private prisons do.
I want to zero in on the first point there, because that has been a major focal point of prison reform efforts so far, that if we decriminalize nonviolent offenses, property crimes, that we can go a long way toward turning the ship around on mass incarceration. If you're saying it's so ineffective, why has that been a focus?
So as a political reality, that's where it had to start. You've had 40 years of unrelenting prison growth. And when reformers started to really push back hard against that, and it started in 2000 a little bit, but it really picked up steam in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis, you're not going to start by targeting serious violent offenses, right? Drugs was the most logical and the most reasonable point to begin a reform effort. So that's where they started. The problem is it's not where we can end. And we have, I think, convinced Americans that we can get most of the way where we want to go just by focusing on drugs. And that's simply not true, even if it was where the process had to start.
Right now, we are talking with John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham Law School, and the author of the book Locked In: The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve real reform. And lastly, you were zeroing in on the prison, private prisons, and the role they may play there. They may have among some circles, among critics, a reputation as being, as you said, profiteers. You're saying we need to look instead to politicians and public public unions for one aspect, and those employed there. And that represents a turnaround, doesn't it? What is happening there when we look at the real beneficiaries?
I think the problem is that the idea of sort of profiting off prison in an explicit way, the way the private prison firms do, horrifies people at a very sort of fundamental level. And I think it's harder to realize that guard unions and the like are basically doing the same thing, right? That they are going to protect their wages just the same way that private prisons are going to try to protect their profits, and they're going to lobby for tougher laws and lobby against prison closures in just the same way. And I think a good example of this comes from my own state of New York. New York has one of the longest declines in prison population nationwide. We've been shrinking since 1999. We've dropped about 25,000 prisoners from 80,000 to around 55,000. Yet spending on prisons hasn't gone down at all. We spend just as much today, if not more, than we did 10 years ago. And that's because the guard unions have been very effective at making sure we don't close prisons, that we lay off guards at a slower rate, and they fought very hard to preserve the money that was flowing to them. And the politicians who have prisons fight for that as well. And so I think the same underlying pathologies exist, but it's not quite so transparent, and so it's managed to sort of sneak under the reformist radar.
What about answering kind of big picture questions like, do prisons work, and what makes for an effective prison, both for society and for the person who ends up incarcerated?
I think that's a great point, and one that's generally underappreciated, which is that the evidence suggests that as a form of crime control, prison is actually a very ineffective approach. It did help staunch the rising crime during the 80s and help bring it down in the 90s, but we could have accomplished the same crime drop in a much more efficient, much less costly kind of way, had relied much more on better policing and less on prisons. There's no evidence that prison deters, that the threat of some long sentence being imposed at some point down the line doesn't affect behavior of those who are committing crimes today. If nothing else, people who commit violent crimes tend to be younger people, and younger people tend to live much more in the moment. They're less forward-thinking. There's also little evidence that we incapacitate effectively. We tend to think that we'll just lock this person up because they pose a threat to society. But the fact is most people, not only do they age into criminal behavior, that, you know, an 18-year-old is much more likely to engage in violence than a 10-year-old, but they also age out of crime. That when you start entering your late 20s, early 30s, you're less likely to engage in criminal behavior. There are hormonal shifts. There are attitudinal shifts. You're just physically weaker. You get married. You have a job. And these are all pathways out of engaging in criminal conduct. And so we tend to sort of throw the book at people just as they're about to start aging out of crime. So it doesn't deter, and it doesn't tend to incapacitate very well. And especially in times like this, where crime is low but prison populations are incredibly high, it's almost impossible to justify our current incarceration rate from a public safety perspective.
Is it really that simple that people age out of crime? Aren't some people maybe lifelong offenders?
They are. There's a small subset that tend to persist for long periods of time. But the challenge we face is that we can't identify who they are when they're younger. There's not many of them, and if we try to lock someone when they're 20 on the risk that they might be offending when they're 40, we're going to lock up many, many people, young people, who aren't going to pose that kind of risk. The other challenge you face is that some of the biggest pathways out of crime are things like marriage and employment. And when you send someone who's young to prison, you make it harder for them to get married or get employed when they come out, so it actually undermines future pathways out of crime if we lock too many people up when they're younger.
We're talking with John Pfaff right now. He's the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What do you think is behind mass incarceration in the United States? How do you think policymakers can solve the problem? Have you ever been part of the prison population in this country? What was it like? What was your experience? You can call us now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll pick up that conversation and get to your calls in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation now with John Pfaff, the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the prison system change in the United States? What do you think is behind the growing number of people in prison? If you or someone close to you has ever been in prison before, you can call and share your experience at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Matthew joining us in Baraboo. Matthew, hi.
Yes, hi. I had a question. I was wondering if the whole plea bargain system has caused some of the mass incarceration, the push to make people plead guilty just to get them through the system faster, has affected that at all.
Matthew, thanks for that. And John, what do you say to that and the role of prosecutors?
I think that's a huge part of it, that prosecutors have played a major role driving prison populations up, and I think plea bargaining plays a big role in that. And I think what really plays a huge part in the plea bargaining process is that the person on the other side of the table from the prosecutor, the public defender, is woefully underfunded. Every defendant in the United States is entitled to a lawyer, and as every Law and Order episode says, you know, if you can't afford one, the state has to give you one. And about 80% of all people facing prison qualify for a public defender. Yet we systematically underfund public defenders just in general, and especially compared to prosecutors. And so prosecutors have a tremendous discretion and tremendous budgetary power, and they're facing against public defenders who are overwhelmed with caseloads they can't manage, and they can't afford to hire investigators, while at the same time the prosecutors simply can use the police to investigate for them for free. Public defenders have to hire lab services. Prosecutors can use the state DNA lab for free. And it's such an asymmetric situation that public defenders lack the ability to really, as dedicated as they are, to really push back against this prosecutorial power. And that makes the plea bargaining process grind on even more powerfully than it has in the past.
And John, you actually suggest having sentencing guidelines for prosecutors.
Exactly. I think that instead of trusting prosecutors to use their discretion, we should impose guidelines on them about what cases they're allowed to file charges against, what cases they're allowed to file misdemeanors versus felonies when they have to divert to a drug court. All these things are completely within their discretion. No court can review them. They get to choose who to charge, what to charge them with. And that's an incredible grant of power that no one else in a criminal justice system has. And no one who has that kind of power, like judges, have it with no restrictions or guidelines whatsoever.
Well, thank you for that call, and we're going to go next to Kyle in Dubuque, Iowa. Kyle, hi.
Hello. I had a question for your guest, though. I was wondering, I've been thinking about this for a while. With the welfare system, I think it pays quite a bit and enough that people will not accept jobs because of if I accept the job, you know, I lose my benefits. And I think when they do that, they have all this free time on their hand and kind of like the idle time is the devil's playground. And I think it also discourages marriage because, if I get married, I'll lose my benefits. And I'm wondering what role welfare plays in it. I know there's a need for welfare, but I think it's being abused so bad, I think it's hurting people and putting them in the criminal justice system more than helping people.
Kyle, thanks for that. And John, is there anything to that? Is there a link between public aid recipients and winding up in prison?
Certainly not that kind of causal connection, that being on welfare pushes you into committing crime because you don't want a job or and you're idle. The people who receive benefits, they would much rather be working. And the fact they're on benefits is more reflects sort of the structural barriers they face to employment. That one thing that defines a lot of, especially minority high crime neighborhoods, is a general systematic exclusion from good work. Right? Those jobs just aren't in poor minority urban neighborhoods, and they lack the social connections to get them. They lack their underfunded schools don't prepare them for that. And so to say that the benefits are what lead them to crime, I think grossly understates the kind of pressures that those people face and sort of the general sort of exclusion from gainful employment that causes them to turn to benefits, not that drives them to crime. And the marriage point, I think, actually is a good segue to show just how much our level of incarceration can throw off, not that incarceration, not welfare, throws off social systems. Marriage and dating functions best in a neighborhood when there's about one man for every woman. You need about a 50-50 ratio. In some heavily policed neighborhoods, we've arrested so many young men that it actually throws off that ratio from 50-50 to, in some cases, it can be as off as 60-40, which does undermine marriage. But it undermines marriage because it's removed so many young men from the neighborhood that it actually makes it harder for women to find partners. And those men who return from prison in these heavily policed neighborhoods, they're even more systematically denied access to jobs. Parts of their parole often denies them access to jobs. It says they can't have contracts, they can't drive cars. And one of the more crazy examples, New York State fixes, other states have not. One of the biggest training programs in prison is barber school. Yet in states across the country, people with felony records are denied barber's license. We train them to be barbers and then deny them access to actually the barbering industry when they leave. And then when they ultimately recidivate because they can't get a successful job, we blame them, not the barriers we placed in front of them to make an already difficult transition all the harder.
Well, thanks a lot for that question. As we talk with John Pfaff, professor of law and Fordham Law School, professor of law at Fordham Law School, I should say, and the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about these ideas, treating people who commit violent crimes differently, changing the sentencing there, changing the way prosecutors approach what they're looking for when they try a case? What do you think of that at 800-642-1234? And we go next to Laura in Burlington. Laura, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. From what I understand and what I've read, approximately 25% of people that are incarcerated are mentally ill. And the guest had indicated that there had been an increase in the 70s. And I'm wondering if that didn't correspond with the fact that we were closing the institutions where a lot of these folks that were seriously ill with mental illness were living. And then the other thought that I had on that is, was that something that he addressed in his book, or I guess just what his thoughts are on it? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, Lauren, thanks for that. And John, what about mental illness as a correlation?
I think the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill that took place over the course, that started actually in the 60s on to the 80s, is one of the things that has it's a very plausible story, but the actual effect is less than people expect it to be. So the best study I've seen on this suggests that about 10% of people in prison would not be there if we had more hospital beds available to them. That's 10% of a 1.5 million person prison system, right? So that's not a trivial number of people. That's hundreds, like almost 200,000 people that get implicated in this. But it's not a primary driver. The story might be different for jails. The difference between prisons and jails is prison is where we send people who have been convicted of a serious crime, a felony, something that requires at least a year in lockup. Jail is for people being held before trial who can't make bail, or people convicted of misdemeanors. And it's quite possible that jails have a much different experience with mental health, because they have in some ways become sort of the frontline intake for mental health issues. In fact, the biggest mental health hospital in the country right now is Cook County Jail in Chicago. Right, so I think that is a serious issue, that we'd be much better served trying to treat the mental illness outside of prison. But I'd also emphasize that the one risk of this, of sort of focusing on sort of mentally ill people in prison, is that it's important to remember that mentally ill people are much more likely to be the victims of crime than the perpetrators. That we sort of this view that those who commit crimes tend to be the mentally ill, and we need to focus on helping those who are mentally ill not engage in violent and other kinds of antisocial behavior. But we don't want to lose sight of the fact that the bigger risk untreated mental illnesses is for being victimized, not for being the victimizer.
And John, as we wrap up, in the beginning of your book, you talk about how Hillary Clinton seemed to be the candidate who would be more sympathetic to calls for prison reform. Donald Trump billed himself as a law and order candidate. So given that Donald Trump is now the president of the United States, where does that leave prison reform efforts?
I think for prison reform, who's in D.C. doesn't really matter all that much. That who really matters at the end of the day is the county elected prosecutor, who answers to almost no one. And there's lots of evidence around the country of prosecutors who even ignore what the governors want them to do. And so I think if they don't want to follow what the president does, they won't. Now, the president might give them some sort of political cover to be tougher if they want to be tougher on crime, but those reformers who want to be, those DAs want to be reformers, I think we'll have the room to do that. And I think one interesting aspect of the 2016 campaign was that while millions of people voted for Donald Trump and his very tough on crime rhetoric, about 20 reform-minded prosecutors won elections against tough on crime incumbents. And that's an unusually high number of defeats for incumbents. And those campaigns were premised on an idea of being smarter.
And we leave it there. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
That was John Pfaff, professor of law at Fordham Law School and the author of Locked In, The True Causes of Mass Incarceration and How to Achieve Real Reform. This is Central Time. We're closing in on St. Patrick's Day, and as you get ready to make your corned beef, your potato soup, maybe your Irish soda bread, you might be missing one thing: Irish butter. Michelle Goods, our technical director here on Central Time, helping us to track this butter story. Michelle, why can't we buy Kerrygold Irish butter here in Wisconsin?
Well, Veronica, an old Wisconsin law is getting new attention, thanks to some media attention. There's a dairy state law from 1954 that prohibits the sale of butter without either a Wisconsin or a federal grade mark.
Right, and Kerrygold butter in particular seems like it's hard to get. It's graded and it's manufactured in Ireland.
Right.
But right now, some people are crossing over into Illinois to buy this butter.
Illegal butter sales, yes. Kerrygold is made with milk from grass-fed cows, and it's hormone-free. It's also cultured, and it is popping up by mistake in some store shelves here in Wisconsin, but not for long.
So I do make, we're not really Irish. Like, a tiny little bit of DNA is Irish in my family, but we do make an Irish meal, and I do tend to buy Irish cheddar, and when I can find it, I have bought Irish butter. What about you?
I've never bought Irish butter before. I have bought cultured butter. You know, I make those herb butters that I give for Christmas.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes the cultured butter gives it a little extra twang, but it's made me very curious about Irish
butter.
You're
not going to Illinois to buy butter?
No. Maybe Polish mayonnaise, but not butter.
Well, this is Central Time.